Seaside FM.
Welcome to Seaside FM Presents, a show that focuses on improving the mature lifestyle with your host, Donna Maryland.
Well, good Thursday morning. It is the last day of August, and welcome to the Seaside FM Presents. And I'm your host today, Donna Maryland, and with me in studio, not only the financial destination guy, but he's like the dream destination guy. Roger Hamilton, welcome to Seaside FM.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
Isn't it a gorgeous day?
It is a gorgeous day. I love it.
It's a perfect day.
It's a beautiful day.
And usually we get right into talking about the financial stuff.
Yeah.
But today, we've got a surprise for everybody.
A bit.
We are going to tell some really great stories about Roger Hamilton and how he, like, where we all know, a lot of people know where he came from. Came from Knoll.
Yeah.
The Knoll Shore.
Yeah.
You were a farm boy.
Yes.
And you had dreams, big, big dreams.
Did I ever?
Yeah.
Did I ever?
Not just riding horses.
No, which I did.
And baling hay.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But you had a dream to be a movie writer.
I did. I was always, I grew up on a farm, so we always horseback rode, and I was always a big, big fan of Clint Eastwood. And any guy or any person growing up in the 60s and 70s, Clint Eastwood was the man.
Girls, everyone loved Clint Eastwood.
So we all loved Clint Eastwood and wanted to be that. So I always, part of my idea, wanted to be a script writer and write movies for Clint Eastwood if I could. So I'd go to, I'd horseback rode when I was 14, 15. I had a hat, I had the saddle, I had the gun, I had the boots.
I was going to say, did you have six shooters?
I had a rifle, and we had, of course, woods roads and lots of woods trails. So I would be High Plains drifter and logging camps. And in August, I'd ride back by myself, and I bought these little Colt cigars. I didn't smoke, so I gave them to the horse and let him have a few puffs. And Dad would kill me smoking in the woods. You know, you can't do that.
Oh, yeah.
Smoke. But I had all the canteen, the whole thing. I was 14, 15. When I was 16, got my driver's license, I started going to movies. all Clint Eastwood movies. After school, I go to drive-ins. I go to the Sackville drive-in, the Enfield drive-in.
Mm. Did you ever go to the drive-in in Cape Breton?
I didn't go to Cape Breton, but I go to Hilton outside of Truro. And I remember every Tuesday night was carload night. $2, the old orange $2 bill.
Yeah.
$2 to go to a Clint Eastwood double feature. And I'd pull up and the guy would say, you know, because he was, how many, well, no, how many in the car? And he's, how many? I said, how many what? How many people in your car? So just me. I just go to movies by myself.
You go to drive-ins by yourself.
I go to drive-ins by myself. I take my clipboard and write down notes about the movie. I want to study the movies. I go to drive-ins by myself, and I'm the only guy there probably watching the movie, because obviously other people weren't watching. I didn't see their heads. You know, they're doing other things, and they're very disrespectful to Clint Eastwood. I'm here to watch the movie.
So you had a clipboard. You brought a clipboard to the drive-in with you to take notes about the movie.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, that's me. So
and what did the guy say the guy that asked you, how many in your car? Would he give you kind of a look and say,
what a loser. Like, you again every Tuesday, it's the same one guy. So yeah, I'd go to drive-ins by myself all from, 1976 and whatever. And
1876?
Well, 1976. It felt like that. The movie would be 1876, all the Westerns. But that's what I did. I just watched, after school and true in the theaters. And I just show up by myself and watch all of his movies all the way through. So.
My mom and dad used to pile us in the car. We'd be in our pajamas and stuff and snacks and things. And we'd go out to the drive-in on Grand Lake Road in Sydney. And one of the best movies I ever remember seeing at the drive-in was The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Oh, yeah. So you've seen them all the time. So it's just and all of his movies are great. The Joe Kids and High Plains Drifter and all the spaghetti westerns and all the Dirty Harrys and all those. And I just watched them time and time. I could memorize the entire, movie, the lines, which didn't really fascinate anybody but myself. But finally, Dad suggested to me very strongly, you should take a girl to a drive-in. So I never thought of that because it probably cost me double, but I guess I'll So in 1976...
This is why he's a financial guy.
Yeah.
It's going to cost me?
Yeah, it's going to cost me money. But so finally in 1977, it was this very pretty girl in school. And I didn't have enough nerve to ask her out. So I got one of my friends to sort of ask. And
I didn't.
And she's out of my league. But she finally agreed to go. I think she must have lost a bet or something. So she came with me to the movie.
Did you have your clipboard?
I did, because most guys back in Knoll and Hants County either drank or fought or went to dances or played ball or hunted deer at night or whatever. I didn't do any of those. And they said, you can't be from Knoll. I am. All I did was, I had banking notes. I just love banking. and baseball.
Banking and movies and baseball.
Baseball stats. So that's all I had. She went to the movie with me. It was a Clint Eastwood double feature. It was Josie Wales and The Enforcer, which both wrote in 76, but I'm watching them again. Mm-hmm. So I take her to the drive-in, and I don't know what to do. I'm just watching the movie. You know, I don't know what's going on.
What's she doing?
Yeah, and so she went to, like, sort of stretch out in the front seat. I said, well, while you're stretching, hand me that clipboard. Let's talk about stretching your budget. I've got some good tips for you that we can go through. And I was 17, and she's like rolling her eyes, like, this guy's...
What have I got myself into?
This guy's a loser.
Help me.
Help me, like, have some fun. Good thing it wasn't cell phones back then. She would have texted her friends, but... So finally, I thought, well, this isn't... I'm losing her, like, this isn't going well. So I thought, left. She didn't want to go through baseball stats, so I'll do some movie lines. So I'll impress her with my Clint Eastwood trivia.
Oh, that impresses the girl, yes.
It sure does.
Yeah.
And think about Clint Eastwood movie lines. They're not that date-friendly, for example. If you say to a girl... You know, go ahead, make my day.
Are you feeling lucky, punk?
Yeah. No one's going to get lucky. You know, that's not going to warm them over. But the worst line I found out using a Clint line on your girl on the first date is the one from Josie Wales. He's, of course, a gunslinger, and he can shoot everybody.
Yes.
And he comes across these four guys in the street who are, you know, thinking about trying to take him in, but they're nervous because they know there's only four of them.
And there's one Clint Eastwood, and you only need one.
Yeah, he's going to shoot them all. Like, four bullets, and they're going to be gone.
Right.
And so they're, you know, reluctant to draw, so he finally says to them, he squints at them, you know, you going to pull those pistols or whistle Dixie. So right before that line, I'm going to impress my girl with this line, like how smart I am. So I sort of look into her eyes and sort of give her the squint, and, well, you going to pull that pistol or whistle Dixie? Well, she misunderstood what I meant by pulling the pistol. Obviously, either that or she's like gunfight scenes, because she's out of the car. Like, I'm done with this guy. She walks down to the canteen and goes...
She went down and met the guy that gave you the ticket.
She did. She went down to the canteen and she'll be right back, hopefully. I see her walking back with a couple of sets of French fries. Hey, she brought me some food. Great. She wanders over to my cousin's truck, Bobby Harvey. He's got a bunch of girls and some beer in the truck, and I'll spend the day with him tonight, and I'm heading to the dance later.
Your loser cousin is on his own.
There's no problem. Here's some notes I wrote for you if you want them. No, okay. And so I just...
Gave her notes?
Yeah, how to invest in stuff. So here's some tips for you. And... thank you.
How old were you?
17. And loser, and okay, no problem. I'll watch the movie by myself. I got my ticket. You have a nice night, and we'll see you later. I'll never see her again. So,
Did you ever see her again?
Well, we might, but I you know, she's out of my league, and I'm happy with the movie, so that's 1977. We'll move on to the next one.
That's hilarious.
I always made sure, though, later on, when I didn't finally ever meet a girl again. Yeah. They had to sign a waiver that they understood Clint Eastwood movies, that they're okay with the lines.
They had to sign a waiver?
Yeah, yeah.
And they had to have their own clipboard.
I'll have one with me, and I'll go through the movie lines with them. You're either a Clint fan or you weren't, so I did go to a lot more movies by myself, because a lot of girls, nah, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, that was 1977.
That was 77.
Let's move ahead to 1984. Because in 1984, you were in university?
I was in university.
In university. Did somebody tell you that you look like John Turner? Now, John Turner, for those who don't know, was our prime minister for, three or four months back in 1984, after Trudeau.
Yep.
And, of course, he was a financial minister.
He was a financial minister from
72 to 75
in the 70s.
Under Pierre Trudeau.
Yep.
So who told you that you look like John Turner?
Well, it was 1984 and the debate between Mulroney and Turner, the famous debate, and Mulroney won the debate and looked very good, and Turner looked very bad. So I'm in university the next morning, and a college friend of mine, Barry Dunn, and Barry Dunn's a well-known actor around here, and Barry Dunn goes on to do Trailer Park Boys.
Yes.
He was Uncle Ray and does a lot of good shows. He was quite talented. We're just joking around the next morning about the debate, and I start imitating John Turner. And Barry's like, you got him. You got him. You sound like John Turner. You got him. So Barry said, put me down to CBC and the makeup lady, Betty Jardine, we can do your makeup in here. And you have the picture right
there. I do have a picture. And I have to tell you guys, he looks so much like a young John Turner.
John Turner. So I started doing John Turner impersonations. We did it on the radio a few times here in Metro and some comedy shows and, you know, political parody. And I'd have the students from the Mount would pretend to be journalists. And they would ask a question again. We have a Brian Mulroney on screen. I never met Brian, but he'd be on screen answering the question.
You hadn't met him yet.
Hadn't met him yet. But I had, he was on screen, he'd answer the question properly, so they could pan over to me as John Turner, and I would answer totally incorrectly, a political parody. You know, they'd ask John something like, was it true that you had a special taxpayer money support your education fund for your four children, all four of your children, John, did you do that? And Turner, of course, would stumble and pause and check his notes. And, you know, according to my records, I already have three children. And so we would do this stuff. And you know, we had too much of the, not enough of the popular vote and too much of the unpopular vote. And so we did that. Barry and I went up to Moncton to do the show in the fall. Election fever. It was a provincial election here at the same time. A big audience in Moncton. And we drove up and did this one show. That's the time when Richard Hatfield, the premier of New Brunswick, had been caught with some marijuana in a suitcase. So that was a lot of political stuff we could use. So I go in, the dogs are sniffing me at the airport, and I'm John Turner, and Rolly Thornhill's in the audience, and I do this thing about John Turner. And we have a good time up in Moncton, and I talk about how I had a joint committee meeting with Premier Hatfield, and so that's how... So we just call that
Premier Hatfield.
So that was 5 months. So 5 months of a little bit of fame back in 1984.
Yeah.
Mulroney goes on to win the election. Turner doesn't. My 5 months. Mulroney gave it to me, the popularity, and then took it away from me as he won the election. So my 5 months of fame were over. But that was the John Turner. That's how I got through some university back in 1984. A little bit of a creative side.
That's amazing. We have that in common, doing impersonations.
We do that? Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine John Turner and Marilyn Monroe together.
Well, he'd be stiff and she'd be tall. Of it, so just like today. Same thing.
I love live radio.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun.
It is fun.
Well, now we want to get to talk about your movies and that you wrote. You actually wrote movies. Like, it's not like an idea. You actually wrote movies.
Three of them. Yeah.
And in 1991,
You
wrote a baseball movie.
I did. I coached the women's of softball back home and back younger. So I made a baseball movie. So I studied how to write movies, which I always want to do part-time or whatever.
And why the baseball movie? What was it that made you want to write a baseball movie?
Write about what you know. So I coached softball, and I sort of used that, and I was a Dodger fan, so I sort of combined the Dodgers and this baseball team. So I studied how to write scripts. Back then, be books and cassette tapes and how to pitch it, how to write it, how to format it a different way. And so when these script coaches, Linda Sager, Michael Haag, and Mike Straczynski, you'd buy their books and how to study how to write a script.
Now, if you want to write a movie, you have to be part of the Writers Guild?
Don't have to be, but but to get involved, yes.
And did you do that?
I was. I was a member of the Writers Guild for a number of years.
Wow.
And so I wrote my first script, I guess, and I sent it off in 1991, a baseball one. I sent it off to Michael J. Fox's agent.
Really?
And they replied back about a couple of months later, we thank you for your, but Michael's busy right now is also, and he also developed Parkinson's, so I don't know if he was able to do the movie, but the movie wasn't good enough, was the bottom line.
But they responded to you.
Very
just,
well.
Just to get a response they is probably
called
good.
Back, was it Mr. Brown or Mr. Benedict, I forget, called me back, I'm not interested, keep writing, it looks, but keep working on it. And so that was 1991. It's okay, so that was fine. And then in 92, my daughter's born, I got my day job, I've got to do my normal job, that's fine. And in 1992, A League of Their Own, the baseball movie comes out.
Ah, with Davis, Tom Hanks and Madonna. Oh yeah, that was a great movie.
50 times better than my idea. So every time I read a baseball movie, they come up with a better one. So A League of Their Own come out in 92. I wrote the second one in 97. I'm not going to write much, but a client comes in to see me, a young nurse, Nova Scotia, and doing some finance, and she had been away to Saudi Arabia for a year, making money and being a nurse.
Nursing in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, and well, that's great, but she fell into a bit of trouble with the Matawa. The Matawa are like a right-wing religious Saudi Arabian who make sure that women don't drive cars and you follow in line and the locals. And so being Nova Scotian and female, you can run into trouble when you don't mean to.
Oh.
She ended up in jail, just different things. I said, well, this sounds interesting. Let's write a movie about this. So we used that.
What did you call that movie?
That was called The Matawa.
Oh.
And so I wrote that in 97, and it was interesting. A friend of mine who was around here knew some local talented actors. Said, how about if we read the script with you? So they put the voices that are in your head. And so we sat around, it was in Dartmouth, and some talented actors. And amazing when you don't know people around here, how talented these actors were from Neptune and local theaters. They would read the parts and just did an amazing job. So they did that. I sent it off to a script consulting place, and they liked it. And I sent it off to a contest in the States. I get to the quarterfinals. I got to about the top 250 out of like 3,000. But then you take like the top five. So you're close, but you're not really close enough. Keep writing. So then that was kind of into that. Well, I'll go back and look at it again someday. But I'm busy working, raising family, doing the normal job, and that's sort of how.
What would you have done different with the movie to make it better?
Well,
like today, if you obviously still have the script. If you were to take that movie and make it better, what would you change?
If I took the time to do it, change the character a bit. Yeah, there's things I would do to it now that would I can improve on it. Knowledge and life and wisdom, I can improve on it, yeah, for sure.
You think you might?
Oh, yeah, I might. Yep.
You might just do it.
I might just do it.
And when you do it, would you contact Clint Eastwood's manager?
Wouldn't be
his. Because you've done that.
I've done it. So, yeah, I contacted Clint Eastwood's manager. So we skip ahead to, so that was the 90s and the 80s. So now we skip ahead to 2010. So now the investment business is going well, and that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I feel this little power surge one night for some reason. And Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino had come out, the movie, in 2008. And he's now 80, and I'm now 50. And, well, if I'm going to do it
time
again,
is passing.
Time is passing. Yeah. It's time to get on with it. So I, being a member of the guild, I knew his agent's phone number. His agent or manager's name was Leonard Hershen.
Mm-hmm.
So I called it one night in July just to give him a call to see if maybe if Clint would be interested in directing this film. I was going to go back to the baseball one. So I called out. I said, well, I'm going to be on hold, and I've got my notes, and someone will...
But on your clipboard? Do you still have that clipboard?
I still have the clipboard.
Okay.
And so they'll bounce me around, but I'll finally, you know, talk to somebody. I dial. The phone rings twice, and the man answers. It's Leonard Hershen.
Wow.
I stumbled. I wasn't ready for him to answer. It's like calling the White House when Obama answers the phone. I'm not ready. And I stumbled through the conversation. He was good. And he was, you know, okay. He wanted to know a couple things. And basically, what do you want to do?
He wanted to know you weren't crazy.
That's basically it. You're not an idiot. And the words he actually said to me later on in the conversation, I realize you're not an idiot.
Oh,
so I will carry on the conversation.
Oh, okay.
So I did want to be, no, this is business.
Right.
Because he asked me, what do you want to do? Shake his hand, pat him on the back. And I think, well, no, can I? But that's not what I want.
Right.
I want to do a script for him. So once we get that rapport,
like you seriously wanted Clint Eastwood to direct
that's
your
right.
movie.
That's right. I don't want his autograph.
Dream big, man, or go home, right?
So the phone call went okay. So then I hung up thinking, I just got off the phone with Clint Eastwood's manager. Holy snap.
Yeah, wow.
So I said, I got an idea. So maybe I can write better than I can speak. So I wrote a little 6-page script. I went down and bought a coffee machine, a Keurig, back in 2010.
Okay.
Did a package, bought some coffees, sent off a little thank you note to Leonard for talking to me. Like, you're his manager, and you spent time on the phone with me.
Well, good
Pretty
for you.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I wrote this little 6-page script called The Coffee Maker.
Yeah.
And at the end of that script, I just had this, that Leonard sits at his desk, package arrives. Hershen, what's this? Oh, it's a box here from some guy, and the camera zooms in from Roger Hamilton. It's got a note on it. Thank you, Leonard, for taking my call. I appreciate it. Oh, so the scene goes on. Leonard opens the box, and I'll get out the coffee machine. Clint enters the room. Oh, what's this, Leonard? What do you got? What's a coffee? Is this from some friend of yours or fan? No, some Hamilton guy from Nova Scotia. Is he a writer? I don't know. I think he is. I don't know, Clint. So they open up the box. They open up the coffee. You see in the background an old coffee machine. Clint, time we get into it anyway, Leonard. This thing's from Dirty Harry. It tastes like crap. And so the coffee's good. And Clint's sort of going on. They're chatting and talking. And Clint finally says, so what's this guy's story anyways? I don't know, Clint. We're talking about other things. I got to talk to Matt Damon and Morgan Freeman. Now, give this guy a call. Something about him I like. Give him a call. And Leonard, are you sure? Yeah, call him. So in the scene, the movie, page 6, Leonard goes to dial. The camera zooms in, and Leonard's starting to dial 902-499-5879. About a month later, I'm in my office in real life, wrapping up with a client at 5 o'clock, and I look down, my phone's ringing. It's Leonard Hershen calling me. I'm getting a call from Clint's manager. I'm not calling him. He's calling me.
Wow.
So I take the call, a bit more prepared now. I do my Fraser Crane Seattle voice. Hello, Roger Hamilton. And Leonard, Mr. Hamilton, thank you for the coffee machine. Well, you're very welcome. Interesting, you sent me a 6-page script. Yeah, I've never seen that before. You've put words in my mouth, which is nice. And, well, I'm a writer. You're creative. I'll give you that. I've never seen one do that. So you've got my attention now. So
yeah,
tell you what.
Good for you.
I tell you what. So this that was good. 6 pages. Now, again, we don't buy movies here, but I tell you what. So we started talking a little bit. So I realized you're not an idiot. Can you write 106 pages, like a full motion picture? Just, yes, I can. All right. If you send it to me, I'll read it. How's that?
Wow.
Good enough.
Clark's
man is going to, that's all I need. So that was August, now September 2010. It's now, we go on to
2011. You're in 2011 now?
2011 in February. I call out to Leonard Hershen. I'm about 6 months into rewriting the script. I'm doing all my stuff. I call out and ask him, are you going to be in Los Angeles this November? Yes, middle of, I should be. Well, by then I'll have my script done. I want to bring it out to you. I'm going down to California anyway. Sure. You want to meet me? Wednesday, November, whatever. Sure. I'll meet you in your office.
Did you get to meet him?
Oh. Might. So, wait for the story.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so April, I go
excited. You got me
April,
excited.
April, I go to Toronto. I meet these scriptwriters. I had their books from the 90s. They're now doing a webinar. So I meet them in person, Linda Sager and Michael Haig, and we write the stories. I get an invite to go to Sundance in August.
That's the Robert Redford.
I was at the Robert Redford Theater.
Wow.
You pitch your movie there. The guy, this script you got, I worked on it much better than 15 years earlier. Mm-hmm. You know a few more things.
Right.
I'm on my way to California in November. Good luck. Oh, Leonard Hershen's going to read your script. Good luck, Roger. Oh, so I go to California, and I land in Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
I stay there for 20 days.
Which, of course, he was the mayor of. Yeah.
So I'm in Carmel.
Clint Eastwood, that is.
That is Clint Eastwood. So I land in Carmel. I stay at Mission Ranch. That's a ranch. That's a facility owned by Clint Eastwood. You can lodge there, and there's a nice restaurant. It's just gorgeous. It's
lovely. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. Spanish. Unfortunately, our Seaside FM listeners can't see it, but it looks fabulous.
It looks great. So in the parking lot where you park at, that silver sedan, that's the sedan used in the Deadpool from Dirty Harry.
Wow.
Careful where you park.
That car right there? Oh, yep. I'm looking at the car from Dirty Harry.
And that is the truck from Bridges of Madison County.
Ah, with Meryl Streep.
Park next to me. Careful where you back up, Roger. It's got a sheet metal firm. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous place. Lots of good food. I meet Clint's father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Clint was 80 at the time, or 81. His wife, Dina, at that time was like 41. Her father would be like 65.
Mm-hmm.
He would be Clint's father-in-law.
Wow.
I meet him at this place. We talk a bit. He's a math teacher. We get along great, chatting. Who sits at the table at supper time? Clint's the head of the table, even though you're the father-in-law. He's Clint. No problem. My back's kind of sore. I go to a chiropractor next door on Monday afternoon, and I go into a chiropractor. It ends up being Clint's chiropractor.
Dr. Michaels.
She gives me some bottles, snaps my back. Here's the bottle I kept.
I have the bottle. There's the original pills in it.
Those are the pills. Some of the pills.
Everybody can hear it.
Clint's chiropractor. So then I have a tour of Warner Brothers Studio next day. That is a picture of me with the Gran Torino.
Look at that. There's Roger with the Gran Torino.
So I'm doing a private tour.
Wow, Wednesday, 1972.
At the Gran Torino 72.
Yeah.
So I call Leonard. I'm in town. I'm going to meet him on Wednesday. So I call Leonard, and he's, oh, Mr. Coffee Maker. Yeah, Roger, how you doing? Nice trip down. Yeah. I script. How about tomorrow? I can't see you tomorrow, Roger. The premiere from J. Edgar Hoover was coming out. J. Edgar, DiCaprio's movie, Clint directed it, premieres tonight.
Yeah.
I can see you Friday. I leave Thursday. I can't. No problem. Leave the script at Mission Ranch. I'll have someone pick it up.
Oh.
You've come this far. I'll give you credit. I'll read it now again. No promises.
Right.
And we don't buy movies. The studio buys them. And if you remember, Unforgiven, which won Academy, sat in Clint's desk for 10 years. So this had better be good. But I'll read it for you.
Right.
No problem. So anyway, bottom line, I left that afternoon. I had nothing else to do. Wednesday afternoon, I go to L.A. by Leonard's office, go to Rodeo Drive. I'm looking for somebody, anybody famous. Might as well make my trip worthwhile. Who do I meet? Walking out of the hotel where they had filmed Pretty Woman. But former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney.
No way.
No way. So you're Brian Mulroney.
You're telling me you used to do
an
impression of John Turner.
We did. We talked to. I used to do the John Turner impersonation. Oh, really? And you took my career away from me. But him and John were now friends and buddies. But he was going off to have lunch with Nancy Reagan. I never got invited. But Brian, a great conversation. I mean, St. Evex, he knows Nova Scotia. And politicians, great conversation.
Did you sing When Irish Eyes Are Smiling
We
Together?
We didn't do that, but we took a picture. There's two Canadian guys that nobody knows in the middle of Rodeo Drive.
That's hilarious.
The former prime minister and the investment guy talking business and finance and movies and Clint and Mulroney and Nancy Reagan.
And by then you are a financial guy.
I am. And I'm getting calls from clients, but they don't know I'm in Los Angeles, so I'm just taking care of stuff. Anyway, so I leave, come back to L.A. I call back to Leonard, but a year later in 2013, another movie comes out. Clint does a baseball movie. Trouble with the Curve.
Yeah.
So every time I write a baseball movie, Hollywood comes up with a better one. So mine's done.
You got to get the better one.
I got to get a better one. So I call back out to Leonard's office in May of 2013. He doesn't respond. I call back out in January. The phone sounds different. Something seems wrong. So I go on the website obituary. Leonard had passed away.
Oh.
He died. I never get to meet him. But in his obituary, he talked about how he always answered his phone. He always called people back and loyal with Clint for like 50 years.
Amazing.
So that's the same method I do in my business, that people call clients, I look after them, I call them back. So that's how that went. So the script didn't go anywhere. I wrote a third one in 2017 down in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a pitch. She was a real good. Nowadays, you could do it online much faster. And back in the 90s, you have to put it in an envelope and mail it off and wait for it.
Yes, now you can.
They can see it. You can run your screen within minutes. They edit it and check it. Mm-hmm. I wrote a third one, and the lady was very good. Said, well, there was a pitch fest in Manchester, Vermont, in this fall. Why don't you come on down, your wife come on down, enjoy, you know, the Vermont and beautiful drive down the fall. But the pitch fest was more for documentaries and TV. Mine was a motion picture.
Right.
Wrong crowd. Went to pitch it. Fell flat. My wife and I went to a gala event. It wasn't really our cup of tea. I'm not comfortable here.
Yeah, a little too
too phony and not around.
Pretentious.
Yeah, yeah. The poodles and the little chihuahuas in their purses drinking tea and coffee. And,
oh dear.
And they were trying to talk with fake British accents. And so, nah, that's not for me. Oh. I want normal people, clients, real normal people. But that's what happened. So I didn't do any more with that. But that's how. But the premise of all that. The one person that said to me, the lady that wrote my scripts, read all three, mm-hmm. you've got good writing ability, good creativity, but the one problem in all your scripts is your main character, you don't put them in enough danger. They're too...
That's because you're a financial guy.
She said...
it's all about not taking the risk.
Right. She said, what do you do? Are you accountant or what? So there's your problem. You don't put your clients probably in risk, but you need to do that in movies. You need to make the character basically more stupid to get them into things and get them out of it so the audience can be invested in them.
But as you've said on your show many times, that sometimes you have to be prepared to take that risk.
Some risk, but
so Roger.
Yeah.
You have to be prepared to take that risk, and you need to...
in the movie business, maybe, but in the finance, no. So I said, I'll be a little bit creative, but I'll keep my clients out of risk and do it that way. So that's what I decided to do. I took that as a lesson, but I'll do my investment stuff, keep them out of risk, and I'll be like Leonard Hershen. I will call all my clients.
And you do.
I do.
You get back to people. You answer pretty much... we won't say 24/7 because Roger does have to sleep, but you
pretty fast.
You get back, pretty fast.
So if Clint's agent can do it for 50 years, I can do it for, that's it.
And, absolutely.
And that's how. So that's sort of how that story went of how that all sort of came to be.
Well, we need to circle back to 1977 because I asked a question earlier, but I got the idea you wanted to wait to talk about it, and you do. So the drive-in. Whatever happened to that girl from 1977 that didn't get the clipboard?
Didn't get the clipboard and found that to be the dullest date of her life. Well, funny, in a script, why was that scene important? What's the John Turner scene got to do with your story? Mm-hmm. It's now September of 2020, 3 years ago, and John Turner, the real John Turner, passes away. He's 92. He dies.
Right.
My daughter, who is now she's 31, she was 28 at the time, does a picture, puts it in Facebook, the picture you have of me of John Turner.
Oh, okay.
This is what my dad did back in the 80s before she knew me, before she was born. Mm-hmm. I'm only 24 back then. This is my dad. They got a few likes on Facebook. I don't follow Facebook, so if you're trying to reach me, don't do Facebook. Email, phone call.
Okay.
Anyway, on Facebook, they got a bunch of likes. Some people in New Brunswick, oh, remember, that's 35 years ago. Wow, yeah, I remember that show. That was good.
Yeah.
One of the people to see it was this young lady who's now 60 from the drive-in movie, sees the picture, friend on Facebook, I guess my daughter. Oh, I'm Roger Hamilton. Oh, yeah. So John Turner.
I remember Roger.
I remember him, the dullest date of my life, but that's the guy in the radio. She's 60, about to retire as a nurse. Now she's happily married, husband, did much better than me.
Three kids.
Three kids, all the whole thing.
Right happily,
but makes an appointment to come see me. It's the fall of 2020, so it's still COVID. She's a nurse, got the face mask on.
Right.
But her eyes are just as pretty as they were 43 years earlier.
When you looked at them and used that terrible line from Josie Wales.
I squinted at her eyes at night, trying to be cool. She comes in the office, her husband, she's all happy, but the eyes are now happily married. She thought, well, if there's one guy that I want to run my money, would be this guy.
Yeah.
This 17-year-old nerd with the banking clipboard. This is who I'm going to have run my money.
Right on.
So she became a client. So I get to say to her one more time as I looked into her eyes, so now we're going to pull those funds, and now you're going to whistle Dixie. And so her funds have done well. She has whistled Dixie.
Oh,
the returns are great.
Yeah.
So to me, that's like the Hallmark love story.
Did she laugh? Did she get it?
She got that part then.
She got it.
A little bit. She kind of forgot me real fast back in the 77s, but she got it, the idea. Anyway, bottom line, her funds are doing well. I knew the line. I knew what I said. I've been waiting 43 years to say this line again.
That's a
riot. We're going to pull the funds, and she has been whistling Dixie ever since.
So you're her advisor, and she's watching her investments grow. And
she's happy. She's happy married, husband, kids. So a perfect love story to me.
It is a love story.
So a couple that don't make it through their first date reunite 43 years later. She's happily married with somebody else. I look after investments. That's love to me.
That's a circle of life. How perfect is that, Roger?
So you asked me about 2 months ago what got me started in the finance business.
Yes.
And I paused that morning and said, it's going to take me a while to explain.
Yeah.
That's the story.
A great story it is.
That's the story.
I love it. I mean, and you know what? We could talk for another half hour with all these wonderful stories.
We skipped some gaps, but those are the highlights.
Well, I'm looking forward to you taking the risk and eventually getting your movie made. Cliff, if you're listening...
If he's out there listening...
Get it done.
I can do another one about the couple that never get together and he invested for. Maybe that's a story.
There you go.
There you go.
I mean, because it's all about investing now, isn't it?
It is investing.
It's important.
And keeping the
in everything,
safe.
Not just in everything in your life.
And there is some risk to everything.
Sure.
And to make it pay off. Exactly.
Yeah, there absolutely is.
That was a fast 30 minutes.
It was a fast 30 minutes.
I had to go quick. I had a lot to...
Well, you've got a lot of information. You've had an incredible life and a lot more life left, so...
I hope so.
Yeah.
Well, if Cliff can do movies at 93 and Leonard was doing stuff at 80, yeah, I'm good to go for quite a while.
Absolutely.
And we'll do it. We do it because we love it. We like it.
Absolutely. And you have to remember, folks, you have to stay safe.
And you have to stay invested.
See how... There it is. There it is right there. Well... Thank you, Roger,
Thank
for
you.
Being here today for Seaside FM
had
Presents.
Some fun today.
We did have some fun. I love these stories. This is great stories. See, and then you can listen to the Financial Destination every Thursday morning at 9:10 to 9:30.
You got it.
Until next time, please be kind to yourself so you can be kind to others. Have a great day, folks. Up next, Sandy B with the Coffee Club.
Seaside FM Presents, a production of Seaside FM Radio, focuses on improving the mature lifestyle with your host, Donna Marilyn, and can be heard Thursday mornings from 9:30 to 10 a.m. here on Seaside FM. From Eastern Passage, we're CFEP 105.9 Seaside FM, your home of the best music.